Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. I'm more wonderful than Paul Orndorff's theme music, more backwards than the crowd at Hog Wild, and I think you're only watching too much wrestling when you ask your wife to grade her period on a Muta scale.
I'm Carl Jones. The second half of 1996 was quite a worrisome time for me. I broke my wrist, meaning I had to wear a cast like Owen Hart, and I then gained weight on what can only be described as a Yokozuna-like scale, resulting in me revealing more crack than was in Sonny's dressing room.
I'm G. John Chase, and finally I got round on watching the Nitros in 95. What surprised me most wasn't how bad the main event product became once Hogan arrived. It wasn't the constant gyrating by Alex Wright. It was how much of a chubby fucker Disco Inferno was when he first started. Someone definitely told him to put the fork down.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke. I've got some bad news this week, folks. Me and my long-term girlfriend of 3 weeks split up. Apparently she says I've got no ambition. Well, I want to fuck Katy Perry and be the first bearded James Bond. If that's not ambitious, tell me what is.
This is the panel for the 39th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear part 3 of our History of the Monday Night War series next. And welcome to the 39th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside Kieran O'Rourke.
Good evening.
G. John Chase.
I've got disco fever.
And Carl Jones.
Slam dunk the funk.
And after a 1 week absence, we are back today to rejoin our History of the Monday Night War series. The last few months we've been doing these. We started in 1995, obviously. You can go back and subscribe to us on iTunes to hear everything that we've done up to this point. We're here for the next 2 weeks to talk about the second half of 1996. We're going to break down the first 3 months this week and the next 3 months next week. All of this is timelined with assistance from Dave Meltzer's Wrestling Observer newsletters at the time, which has been bringing about a lot of very, very interesting facts and kind of killing a lot of misconceptions from this period of time. So this should be an interesting look back, probably the most fascinating 6 month period we've discussed so far. So there's not much time to waste. We've got a lot of notes to get to here, so we'll start with July 1st as both Raw and Nitro go head to head. Nitro, it's the go home show for the Bash of the Beach. The Outsiders come out at the beginning of the second hour of the show to huge babyface reactions, says Dave Meltzer, and sat in the front row eating popcorn holding their tickets. Nash is actually called Kevin Nash on this show. It's the first time he's given a name. And during the Rey Mysterio video that they were playing, they have Hall and Nash jump the barricades, police are coming. Kind of, you know, very disruptive scene. The heels and the baby faces come out on the WCW side to kind of stand them off. Very, very interesting scene as we get ready for Bash at the Beach here. But it should be noted that it's an otherwise bad show, headlined by the Horsemen against the Renegade, the Rock and Roll Express, and Joe Gomez, with one of the greatest blown finishes I've ever seen in my life, where Mongo tries to throw the briefcase at Renegade, and Renegade fucking just eats it on the canvas, head first from the top rope. A truly ugly sight to behold. Bash at the Beach is around the corner. Thoughts on the go-home show here?
Well, first off, I'm guessing Mongo didn't do his rails that night.
Apparently not.
I should say, when they first went to 2 hours, the countdown to the second hour absolutely fucking infuriated me. They'd like completely ignore what was going on in the ring.
Yeah.
Fireworks go off.
Yeah, and then even on many occasions, there would be matches going on whilst they're doing this countdown. It's complete piss poor timing, which would become prevalent in later years.
I think the July 1st show, it was Savage. And the match finished like 5 seconds to go before Bischoff turned up. I guess that's what the fireworks were for. And then I think the next week the match was going on. They just fucking ignored it and did their intros and then continued talking about the match. Oh wait, we've got a match going on, folks. We know because we were watching before you turned up, Eric. But I think not soon after that they kind of quietened it down and didn't make a big deal out of it. So thank God.
It's very much just a continuation of this outsider threat in the sense that you've got the heels and baby faces coming together. On the subject of, you mention it's the first time that Nash is mentioned by name, is this, because my chronology is a little bit out here, is this after WWF have issued the legal warning?
Yes, it is. Okay. Talked about on the last podcast, actually, all the issues, all the things that the WWF didn't want them to do. They even tried to get Nash to shave his goatee because it's too much like Diesel. But it was getting very, very petty at that stage.
Yeah, I think they established it, didn't they, by Great American Bash, where they do that whole promo with Eric Bischoff, and Eric Bischoff asks them, are you employed with the WWF?
Yeah, and
confirm they're not.
Yeah, so obviously it's called Kevin Nash here.
Just, even though I say he wasn't really, it was slow evolving with the NWO coming in, you know, there's only two of them at this time, but real the premise of the NWO gimmick, of being outsiders, separate from the rest of the company, different, you know, these angles which were, you know, impromptu kind of thing, rather than the wink-wink wrestling that we're used to, obviously. it's the whole premise for the gimmick was, you know, it's still ongoing here. It wasn't you know, 1 week done. It was a slow thing, and it was no real problem with the storytelling at this point.
No, not at all.
Even like, you know, Nash and Hall getting cheered. It's like, it wasn't. Yeah, it's because they were cool and they were doing cool things and they were sitting there, but they were outside. They were, you know, they were an attraction sitting in the crowd. It wasn't at this point. I wasn't offended like it's heels being cool baby faces for the sake of it because they wanted to be.
Yeah.
Which we will come on to
over the coming months.
But yeah, I mean, this is all really good, interesting stuff. And
Nash drops an F bomb here, I believe.
Oh yeah. Get the fuck off. Brilliant.
I remember this that angle vividly. Nothing else on this Nitro, and I watched it back recently, is in my mind at all, other than Nash in that segment screaming, Look at the clowns as Luger, Sting and Savage come out with their faces painted. Over on the other side on Monday Night Raw, Shawn Michaels versus Marty Jannetty, Battle of the Rockers. Jeez. And Goldust versus Mark Mero is the main event with the Marlena Sable lesbian tease. If you remember Marlena checking out Sable from behind, it's actually quite funny because Vince is on commentary, and at the end of this whole thing where Marlena's checking Sable out, Goldust kisses Marlena and Vince just goes, "What the?" It's incomprehending that Goldust would do something that a straight man would do.
Static cling, I think, was what was checking out.
Oh yeah,
static cling on the ass area, I believe, was the story. Yeah.
WCW gets a 3.3 rating for this Nitro compared to Raw's 2.6. Since Kevin Nash's surprise debut, the Nitro after that, as a matter of fact, WCW hasn't lost a Monday Night yet. So we'll see how that goes if you don't know already.
Up until Great American Bash, where they pretty much confirmed that they're not with WWF, there's this whole persona that these guys are WWF, and yet they're just kind of running over all the WCW guys. And it's like this kind of almost like this clear signal, like even in WCW's own company, even though it's their own angle and everything, they were making WWF like being superior to them as a brand, that only two of their guys could come down and kick the crap out of half their roster.
Well, it's the proper way to book an angle like that, at least in its infancy. How many times do we sit back now and look at the sort of the way that someone is brought in and immediately buried because they weren't that, you know, in typical Vince fashion, it wasn't Vince's creation, so, you know, we'll maybe give him a bit of a push, but we'll ultimately bury him, whereas, obviously, juxtaposition with this, where you've got them killing the WCW guys. And in fairness to, in reference to sort of Kieran's earlier point about not being offended by sort of the heels getting the babyface cheers, it didn't bother me so much like yourself, because at least they were still acting like heels. They weren't sort of pandering to the crowd really in any way.
It's interesting though, because that whole thing that you mentioned there about treating the WWF guys like they were the superior guys, that was kind of a lot of the issue with a lot of the WWE fans. They've been doing that since Hogan had come in and bigging up how is, you know, this is the best world heavyweight champion of all time.
Like, back in the day, you used to have like the guys in the crowd dressed in the suits like the horsemen and stuff. You know, you've always going to have heel fans.
Yeah.
And you know, it was so different, and of course they weren't cheered. But it was like the intrigue as well.
I was going to talk about the intrigue being the key of it, because they actually hadn't beaten up anybody apart from Bischoff yet at this point, if I'm not mistaken. They hadn't laid a finger on anybody but powerbomb Bischoff through the table at the Great American Bash. There'd been a lot of threats and a lot of standoffs, a lot of confrontations.
Yeah, and little things like they'd sit in the crowd and they'd sit on three seats and they'd leave the middle seat empty. It's like, who's the third man? Massive intrigue to tune into the shows. And like, as it would go on, obviously this was, you know, building up to Hogan that week. But like, after Hogan, when they'd be like four seats, they weren't even there, so they weren't in the crowd, but there's four seats. It's just very little sort of great things. Like, oh, we're going to keep watching because they're definitely here. We've heard the rumours they're here. So we'll keep watching, and there might be four, so we'll definitely keep watching. So
yeah.
Really, really good stuff.
So here it is, July 7th, the Bash at the Beach. Here's some stats for you. 8,300 fans in Daytona sold out. They turned 2,000 people away at the door. But it only did a 0.71 buy rate. Last year's Bash at the Beach with Hogan and Vader actually did better than this pay-per-view did, surprisingly enough. Obviously, the big story of the show is the Hogan heel turn. Great rain psychosis match at the start of the show, but the Hogan heel turn is obviously the thing that really is the big issue here that changed the landscape completely in the Monday Night War that we're here to talk about. A little bit of news from Meltzer here. Hogan, and actually, I should say, Meltzer actually did have it in the Observer the week before that it was going to be Hogan. So if we were subscribers at the time, we would have known. Hogan had agreed to do the heel turn about 11 days before the show, largely because there was no place left in WCW for him had he not chosen to do so. Hogan's contract with WCW was scheduled to expire after two more pay-per-views. There was a whole situation where Hogan went to do a movie right around the time of the NBA playoffs in May, where Nitro got preempted and the ratings obviously got fucked in the ass because the show was preempted. So Hogan, of course, used this time to strategically do the movie so that he wouldn't be on when the ratings would go down. Hogan's idea being he would come back when the playoffs were finished, the ratings would go up. However, what happened was, because they went to 2 hours, Bischoff kind of launched 2 hours of Nitro in a panic move when the ratings started going down, the ratings picked right back up. So by the time that, you know, Bash of the Beach comes around, Hogan was completely exposed as not being that important in the ratings. The pay-per-views and Monday Nitro ratings are obviously the key thing. So Hogan had pretty much kind of been made expendable for the first time since he'd been in WCW. There was fear that Hogan was going to change his mind at the last minute, as he's done many times in the past, and the plan B contingency on the night was that Sting would do the heel turn and join the Outsiders, largely due to the belief that too many people had speculated about Luger or Savage turning, but nobody had speculated on Sting, and the company wanted a shocking finish to the show. So any other thoughts here on Hogan's heel turn on the night, and obviously what this means in the big picture?
It had been, although Hogan was initially reluctant to turn heel, in truth it had been coming, hadn't it? I mean, the NBA playoff bit that you referenced there, I don't think it was the first time that Hogan had pulled that sort of act. He'd done that before, if I'm not mistaken, yeah. And would go on, even with him being exposed there, would go on to try it again in later years. He'd been getting dog's abuse from a lot of those crowds. I mean, can you remember?
As soon as we talked about this in the previous episodes of this show, I mean, you know, the boo birds were certainly calling as soon as Nitro was live.
He really was cornered, I think, and to remain relevant, it's what he had to do, regardless of what reservations he may have had.
So I just think that this angle, I thought it was so well done. The whole execution, the whole, you know, the garbage in the ring, you couldn't have wanted this to go better if you'd done this 100 times.
And how, just on a side note, how wonderful was Heenan?
Oh, Heenan was great.
I know we've mentioned this before in previous podcasts, but how great was he on the night?
He was great for the whole month building up, I thought. And him, you know what, Bischoff, Schiavone too, I thought the announcers do deserve a lot of credit during this period, because I thought they did a really good job of making this seem like this was the biggest deal in the history of WCW, and that it could be anybody's the third man.
What really kind of sold those angles was Heenan's commentary, because when you have, it's okay for the two babyface play-by-play guys to turn around and say, oh, these despicable men that are coming in and doing this, but to have the heel color commentators, dastardly as Heenan, there's no one lower than Heenan to turn around and say, whoa, these guys, I can't deal with this. Like, every time they'll turn up or whatever, he would run away, whether it's before or after what we're talking about now, he would always run away. And so it's always kind of like, wow, if someone like Heenan is intimidated by these guys, then this is the fucking shit right here. They're going to fuck things up.
The only thing I want to say is, on the Hogan situation, could it have worked with anyone else?
Not as well.
Not as well, no. This is interesting, because for
me, not anyone they had, anyway.
What about Savage? Because it had to be a former WWF guy.
I know G will hate this, but no, not with Savage. Because, in Hogan, regardless of whether you love him or you hate him, and he's got that sort of that Marmite characteristic to him, he was the babyface of the 1980s and the early 90s. So for it to be the one singular biggest attraction at that time in wrestling history and the biggest babyface to boot, to then all flush that down the toilet... You know, that it's that real stark contrast that you need.
Yeah.
And Savage had been a heel on the national stage before, and on more than one occasion. You know, he'd been heel twice within the space of around 3 years, in terms of his, you know, heel run to babyface champion, back to heel to drop the belt to Hogan. So it doesn't have that jarring impact that a Hogan heel turn has, I don't think. On the subject of the low buy rate, if I can just mention that.
Well, not less than low, but low than maybe expected.
No, sorry. You're very right there.
We'll come to low buy rates.
Yeah, you're very right there. Not low, but possibly not what would have been anticipated. I would imagine that is largely to do with this notion of people, whilst they'll be intrigued for a TV show on a week-to-week basis that they're only paying for as part of their, so you say, cable subscription, so they're getting it anyway. It's a different story to try and hook someone on the basis of that intrigue and then to stump up $20 for a pay-per-view. You know, that sort of, you're parting with the cash for something that you don't really know what's going to happen.
Don't know if you're going to be happy with
it. So if you think there's a chance you're going to be disappointed, you're going to be a bit more reluctant to put your hand in your pocket.
It's something that mentioned, you know, anyone but Hogan. I agree, and I think it's kind of, the reason I bring it up is kind of the changing of the premise of the NWO. It started, you know, they're the outsiders, the invasion, blah, 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 blah. When Hogan joins for me, it takes on a new life because it's no longer the phony war kind of thing.
Well, at first they tried to tie it together because one of the lines on the bash is Shavising. I guess this goes all the way back to 94, with the idea being that this, you know, Hogan came in as a secret double agent kind of a thing.
But I think that at that point, I think that was kind of out the way. That didn't have any traction really. I think it was more the fact that it was you know, the biggest star of all time finally going heel. So yeah, I just think it's a very interesting kind of almost changing of the premise of the angle from that. The kind of the invasion style to just a heel group but it was the Hogan heel group, so it's a subtle change of the angle for me, but took it to the next level.
Yeah, and especially in the sense of with Hogan being a heel, yes, he had been a heel in the past, but in terms of that television audience at the time, they weren't aware of his AWA run as a babyface, they weren't aware of his heel running the WWWF, you know, so to this audience who'd only ever known him as a babyface, that's why I think it's so jarring, and that's why I think it has to be him ultimately.
When you look at the other options, you know, you mentioned Sting, Savage and Luger. Luger isn't an option because Luger was a failure in the WWF anyway, so him to come along and say, oh, I'm part of the WWF invading, it's like, yeah, right.
Yeah, but at the same time,
we don't believe that for a second.
The original idea was that obviously it was going to tie into the fact that on the first Nitro ever, Luger showed up, so he was like the plant immediately as soon as Nitro started. So it was their way to try and, I mean, ultimately, let's not lose sight of what this was. The idea was the WWF's coming here and they're going to lose the WCW. Probably what they were hoping for in the beginning, at least. Yeah.
With Sting, I'm a fan of Sting and all, but I wouldn't like to turn around and say I don't think he could have done it, because I'm sure, like, with determination, he could have, but he's not the right kind of character or persona to fit in with those two guys. He's definitely more the opposition. He's the WCW guy that you have face him, definitely. Savage is the only option. He is a distant second to Hogan. Hogan was the blatant obvious one, but I think Savage could have carried it across, being like well known as a WWF guy. He was part of, you know, he wasn't far behind Hogan in terms of debuting in WCW. He was just like a few months behind. So, you know, Savage would have made sense. The promos would have still been of a good quality. They would have been different to what Hogan was doing, but it's just blatant that the whole angle, it needed that Hogan turn. It needed that absolutely shocking moment. It's just like the look he gives, and then like they get into the ring, and this Hall's just doing the poses and that, and you know, and Nash is just, you know, looking like his douchey self as usual, and they just proceed to do probably, well, yeah, absolutely, without a doubt, Hogan's greatest promo, I think.
Though he still fucks up the name of their own group.
Well, yeah, the New World Organization of Wrestling, brother. But still, that, like, just the things, like, you know, and all this trash in the ring represents all these fans out here. And you're just thinking, like, do you know what? Those lines, the way he delivers that does not sound like a guy that was unsure about what he was doing. Those were delivered with panache and like a certain degree of, like, he's getting a lot off
calculation,
and he's kind of getting maybe a little bit of stuff off his chest. Don't know, but the thing I was more worried about in terms of like his merchandise sales was Pastamania affected.
We can only wonder. Let's move on to the next night now. So July 8th, moving on to Monday Night Raw here, first of all, Warrior's indefinite suspension was announced by Gorilla Monsoon. You might remember that Warrior no-showed three dates at the end of June. Monsoon stated that Warrior will be welcomed back provided he posts an appearance bond, which in fact is basically the truth. The exact amount that Hellwig will be required to post will be well in excess of $100,000. Also on the show, vignettes air with Shawn Michaels and Ahmed Johnson doing the promos to reveal Sid as Warrior's replacement at In Your House 9 International Incident.
Okay, now just bear this in mind. we've talked there about sort of great vocalists, if you will.
Okay.
In terms of Bobby Heenan on commentary, Hogan cutting the promo of his life, and WWF's response to that is, you know, Squeegee Boy Sid and Ahmed Mr. Incomprehensible Johnson.
That's a... Go ahead.
What fucking language was he speaking? It wasn't English. It wasn't even ghetto English. I have no fucking idea what it was. But Sean didn't either, because when Sean was in the vignettes, it was Sean and Ahmed. The first one, Sean realised, like, what the fuck is this guy saying? He gives this look to the camera like, I have no fucking idea what he just said, and smiles to himself. The next one, they come back for it, Sean, like, obviously, you know, it's going to be exactly the same again. So he just starts pulling faces at the camera and puckering up when Ahmed's bumbling and mumbling about something, I think. Or...
Oh, that's saliva. Meanwhile, on the other channel... Yeah. Also, on Nitro, however, there's no Hulk Hogan on this show. Rey Mysterio does win the Cruiserweight title from Dean Malenko in a fantastic match, one of my favourites from this period of time. In the main event, Sting beats Arn Anderson. There's a bit of a standoff here with Sting and Savage and the outsiders on the outside of the ring. Sting does what I think might be his best promo of his career up to this point on this show, where he talks about how, Hulk, you can stick it. And it's the whole thing of, you know, the pro WCW guy does such a great promo. Gee, I hate to say this, Savage followed up with a fucking terrible promo, if I can be quite honest. Compared to what the one that Sting does, Savage is completely off the page. However, Nitro, ratings 3.5 towards 2.5. Full point victory here, but not a noticeable jump here. 3.3 the week before, 3.5 this week, which you'd expect might be a little bit bigger for such a shocking move. Interesting.
Well, you got to bear in mind, though, is a different... maybe...
I suppose, spend the whole show talking about
it. Yeah, you'd expect probably, you know, more to tune in for the intrigue, but as a bump the next night from the night before... Bear in mind, this is early infancy of the internet, and you know, the
info still isn't quite so fast.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I suppose, you know, maybe I'm wrong there, because maybe you'd expect more to tune in to actually see what happened. But,
yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, I don't think you were going to get like a spike as soon as that. I mean, unlike certain other kind of happenings that you know that WWF had, you know, with Tyson or whatever, was the Hogan heel turn like, you know, heavily shown on like news or news networks or anything like that?
No, probably not.
Not really. So how was something like that, other than the people who are already tuning in to Nitro, how are new people going to find out about this angle?
WCW has made a 3-year, $400,000 a year offer to Davey Boy Smith. WWF has countered with a $250,000 a year contract, downside guarantee, for 5 years. So WCW has made the big offer for Davey Boy, who handed in his notice in June.
Again.
Yeah. The Los Angeles Times this week had a lengthy article about Olympic weightlifter Mark Henry, who's being sponsored by the WWF and will probably join the company after the Olympics. He said the WWF is more honest competition than Olympic lifting because of the steroid policy. Henry said he's been tested for steroids 40 times in the last 18 months in the Olympics, which is a lot more often than a WWF wrestler would be tested. Just keep that in mind later on. Also, in other articles, the July 9th Village Voice had an article ripping the Goldust character, saying Goldust has brought homophobia to new levels.
Village Voice.
Yes. Yeah. So just continuing the bad press that this gimmick is getting here. Moving on to next week, July 15th Nitro. This is the first appearance of the heel Hulk Hogan, Hollywood Hulk Hogan. The main event is the always great Lex Luger versus Bubba Rogers. Hull and Nash do the running attack Lex Luger. Hogan walks out for a promo, which actually I thought was another really good promo from Hogan. Two in a row. And WCW surrounded the ring with Hogan, Hull, and Nash in the middle of the ring as the show goes off the air. So, first impressions of Hogan's heel work on television?
But I remember the first few times was pretty interesting because and the work was good because it was very minimal at the time. They weren't doing too much with him. It was once there's a storyline kind of advanced a little bit and he started coming out more during the shows and so on. That I think
not as much as Goldust apparently.
Well, yeah, I think it was after the first couple of shows that maybe issues started to occur with like Hogan, maybe not quite getting the gist of where the NWO is going. Something I don't want to go too far ahead into
the
vignettes and so on where he's just rambling on. I think his first couple of appearances were very controlled, so he comes across looking very well. I think once it kind of expands a little bit, he kind of loses his way for like a few promos here and there.
What I really liked, and I probably could, like, see it rubbing people the wrong way, but from a promotional point of view, how on those first few Nitros, everybody, it was interviews, no matter what guys were cutting promos about, Gene or whoever would ask them.
Yeah, the Horseman, the Dungeon.
Yeah, can we have your comments on the Hogan NWA? So it was guys who weren't directly, you know, hadn't been attacked or weren't in direct conflict with them. But it just emphasised the importance
The gravity of
the angle. Yeah, and it's like we bang on so much about WWE these days, about there's no emphasis on angles for people like Wyatt, etc. This was complete opposite. This is complete focus of the company on this one angle. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, it was.
It just shows you what you can do. I mean, it's only a 3-man group. That's the thing. It was a 3-man group, and the entire company was like practically scared of it. Was just like, whoa, what are these guys? What are they doing? You know, and it's just like it was just really well booked, and just it hasn't really been replicated again since.
No, because too many people are sort of. And it seems ironic to say where the NWO are concerned, but too many people are invested in their own sort of self-protection now. And I'm not saying that these three guys weren't like that. Don't get me wrong, folks. But to go back to what I said earlier, it's how an invasion angle has to be built. You have to make it the be-all and end-all, because if you don't, it's not really much of an invasion, is it?
No.
Yeah, you know, if it's just a little side story.
Your ex back in Tajiri wrestling for the cruiserweight title and they don't care about WCW, then they're not really doing too good a job on this angle.
There you go. It's case. Just mild case. Yeah, case in point. In regard to Hogan's appearance here, though, if I remember rightly, it's the first time we see him dressed all in black since his quote unquote turning to the dark side of a year or so previously.
Morning.
And he's got that great, cocky, arrogant smirk as he just sort of doesn't strut out, but it's very much a saunter,
glides his way,
chin up in the air, and you know, real smug piece of shit. And just on a side note, in terms of them being a threat and sort of overtaking everything, although it may not seem significant on first viewing, the fact that the Outsiders and Hogan didn't just attack Luger, the fact they attack a member of the Dungeon of Doom as well, you know, it just shows that everyone's in the way, everyone's collateral, you know, there's no sort of ally here if you're not with the NWO.
Faces and heels.
Exactly. Breaking down that sort of wall, and everyone's fair game, and it just, I think it helps accentuate that element of threat that they're going for everyone and not just baby faces.
However, on the other channel on Raw, they ran a storyline throughout the show that was taped a few days earlier at the Civic Center, because the angle they did with the Warrior that was pre-taped that they couldn't show anymore, where Cam Cornette ambushes Sid and Ahmed, then Sid comes driving up in a Lincoln and chases the heels away into their own car. Pretty sure
he had a squidgy.
He did not have a squeegee, sadly.
Smuggling a hamster, though, maybe.
Sean versus Billy Gunn is the main event here. Shockingly, Raw does not win. the show built around Hogan's first heel appearance. There's a 3.4 to Raw's 2.6. In other news this week, the 1-2-3 Kid was given his release from the WWF, and he's expected to join the Outsiders very soon. More on that later.
Big one.
July 21st, International Incidents in Your House. 14,804 fans pack the arena. 92,000 buys on pay-per-view. 0.37, complete fucking horrible buy rate for this show. Vader gets a very cheap win over Shawn Michaels in the six-man tag main event here. Vader, who'd been kind of not made to look too good as a monster heel pretty much ever since he's come in the company. And again, listen to the previous show for more on Vader during this period of time. But, Jake Roberts was also no-showed this event, in a funny little note that we'll come back to later on as well. No real explanation, he's back on Raw, and he's just... no one's any the wiser. So, there you go.
I think the only thing that shocked me about it was the fact that Vader pinned Michaels.
Yeah, yeah. Even though it's with Jim Cornette's help, you know, he doesn't do it on his own. Monday Night Raw the next night, July 22nd. Show is pretty weak. Good Eddie Guerrero psychosis match, with psychosis doing the psycho twister from the top to the floor, and a move that I'll never forget. I'll remember that forever. The big angle was Nash and Hall going to the control room and bullying the directors and producers until security booted them out. Sting, Savage, and Luger over the Horsemen in the main event here.
Was that the first time where they did something like that, where they actually showed you something like the production truck? And something like, they showed like you the backstage workings, like the director and everything.
Strictly speaking, no, because you'd had shows like the Action Zone and things like that.
Livewire.
Livewire, Coliseum Home Video, where they'd showed you the behind the scenes type thing. But it was the first time, to my mind, that you really saw it in terms of a storyline where it was prevalent.
Yeah. Yeah, and thankfully it saved us from a horrible Dungeon of Doom 8-man tag, if I recall correctly, as well. Yeah. Over on Raw, the TV main event sees Shawn Michaels and Ahmed Johnson, the WWF and Intercontinental Champions, beating the Smoking Guns, the tag champs, by DQ, when Ron Simmons, dressed up as an Egyptian, attacks Ahmed Johnson. Lawler on commentary says it looked like Ron Simmons, only bigger. So this is Farooq Assad making his debut. Yeah. Not a bad match, though, in the main event here. But for the first time since it went to a two-hour format, Nitro's ratings fell in the second hour, so a testament to how bad the show was, perhaps. A 2.6 overall rating for Nitro. Raw only did a 2.2. However, the second hour and Raw in general went head-to-head with the Olympics, which explains the low ratings here this week. A bit of an outlier. Blood Runs Cold, who are supposed to debut this month, is going to be five or six martial arts guys doing a martial arts style of wrestling that only wrestle each other. It doesn't sound promising, but after seeing the Leprechaun in the Dungeon of Doom, I figure any idea can no longer be the worst, says Dave Meltzer. Anybody get into Glacier's build when they were doing these endless, seemingly endless videos to bring him in?
No, because whilst we have in the past praised WCW and the production side of things in the way that it looked really fresh and really vibrant in comparison to Raw and the WWF, which had that very stale vibe to it, the Glacier vignettes came off like a real cheap-ass B B-movie sort of production.
Mortal Kombat ripoff.
It was just a Mortal Kombat ripoff. You're sitting thinking, it's just a shitty Sub-Zero.
Could he do karate then?
Oh yeah, he's a legit karate dude.
These videos were so bad, they made it look like he couldn't do karate.
Oh, he's so slow throwing his kicks and everything.
Fucking
like
atrocious videos. They are terrible.
Bischoff, who's a mark for martial arts anyways,
it's all just about Bischoff getting his jollies off.
Gotta keep in mind that when he actually devised this angle, he was very much still in the Dungeon of Doom frame of mind, I'm guessing, earlier in the year. These vignettes had ran for so long. WWF has gotten cold feet on the lesbian angle due to all the negative press that Goldust's been getting. It's been changed from Marlena having the hots for Sable to Goldust having the hots for Sable, and Goldust is just having Marlena give Sable presents as opposed to the other way around, which it's supposed to be. So, Kieran, I know you must be very sad you never got to see the Sable-Marlena exchange there.
I blame the Village.
The Village voice.
The Village needs to keep its voice down, in my opinion. There's not a lot more I'd would have liked in 96 than seeing those two.
Maybe go Sonny in there.
Oh yeah, Sonny. Well, come on, Sonny. Literally. Enough of that.
Speak for yourself.
Sonny was so fucking hot. I'd still do it today from the memory of how hot she was back then. So.
In September, we'll undergo yet another change to the industry's landscape. Titan Sports has made a decision to drop compensation when it comes to its syndication package. The costs of maintaining a syndication network nowadays are more than the income that national advertising can garner, or else WWF wouldn't have made this decision. So obviously, the impact of Raw and Nitro here is pretty huge in the sense of syndication, which was the WWF's, you know, their entire base of operations in terms of running house shows locally, is now a thing of the past. Based solely on local advertising and the momentum of Raw and Nitro, it's not really needed anymore. Superstars moved to USA, if I recall correctly, around this time as well. Moving on here, this is a good one. The original plan for Mind Games, the September pay-per-view, is currently scheduled to be, get this, Shawn Michaels and Jose Lothario versus Davey Boy Smith and Jim Cornette. Get your wallets out now. as well as an IC title match with Ahmed Johnson versus Vader. So I don't know why they thought Davey Boy in a pay-per-view main event was a good idea after the three previous showings he'd given us.
So this Shawn run, you know, we're massive Shawn fans, and you know, as a main event worker, he was the man. But goddamn, he was so fucking. I would have booed him if this happened. I would have booed Shawn myself. I would have thrown something at him. Oh, I just insufferable. You know, I get it. Vince is trying to make Shawn the ultimate Tom Cruise babyface champion kind of thing. Fine, we get what you're trying to do, but Shawn looks so uncomfortable and
uncomfortable with Jose too.
Oh, Jose, yeah, fuck Jose. He's trying to walk off in front of him like Chase said before we went on air. It's like going shopping with your parents and you're trying to walk in front of them saying I'm recognised the 2 years ago. Just yeah, I mean, it was not good for Shawn.
Not good at all. Moving on to the July 29th Nitro. This is where we have the big angle where the Horsemen are wrestling Sting, Savage and Luger. Jimmy Hart says there's something going down in the back. We get the lawn dart throw of Rey Mysterio into the side of the trailer, as well as the
Bisco,
as well as the beatdown of Arn Anderson, Scotty Riggs, the American Males, and the great Savage riding the limo.
Yes, wild man Savage.
you just know that was not planned. That was Savage spontaneously thinking, I'm going to climb on this fucking limo. I can just imagine, like, as he's just driving off, just Nash and Hall just looking at Savage. Nash, as he,
what are you doing, Matt?
Savage, what the fuck are you doing? The car's
I'm in now, I can't get out. Real, yeah.
I say, at this point, it's kind of... Oh, one more thing. Who am I on this angle? What happened?
Oh, you're Mongo.
I'm Mongo.
I can't believe this.
It's like death or something. He's just shouting at the top of his lungs.
Yeah, you've got Mongo raving like a lunatic, Savage chasing after the limo,
woman crying.
Woman crying is a real, I don't want to say masterstroke almost, yeah, for this. It just really, really helps sort of accentuate sort of a grittiness and almost realism to it that, in comparison, you're not getting from the other side at this stage. This is hands down, in terms of the early NWO run, my favourite angle. I absolutely love this bit backstage.
Yeah, again, so much gravity given to this attack. It plays out for so
you
long.
You got Jimmy Hart running to the ring, just frantically waving and screaming around, trying to get any person he can's attention.
It was fantastic. I said he went so, I'm not sure, maybe 15, 20 minutes, how long. But the execution, they, you know, we've got no, well, the guys who are in the next match, they're down. So, you know, they just, nothing happened. The only thing, obviously, that brought it down was the crowd in the background chanting, boring.
Boring, yeah.
Which Bischoff, I'm not sure if they could or couldn't see it, but Bischoff is trying to put it over as well. You know, they can't see what's going on here. This is, you know, this is a bad situation. We completely understand. Yeah. But, just, in terms of, like, being different to anything you'd see as wrestling fans at that time, it was so it was fantastic.
And again, it's that situation where you've got babyface and heels commingling again.
Yeah.
You know, looking over sort of the fallen comrades in a sort of quote unquote war.
I think it's, I can't remember who gets in the ambulance, but is it Sting and Flair getting in the ambulance with Arn?
Yeah.
So Arn and I can't remember who the face is in the ambulance, but there's two guys.
Riggs.
It's Riggs, because they try and explain that although they're not, him and Sting aren't on screen friends, they are, you know, they're back, you know, away from wrestling, you know, they are friends. Yes, and so Flair and Sting, obviously rivals for so many years, get in this ambulance together, and you hear him, someone says like, "You two, nothing's going to happen," and they're like, no.
This is also the first mention of a fourth man. I think Rey Mysterio mentions here. There was four of them.
You've got Eddie sort of over Rey, sort of trying to almost, you know, cup his head up almost.
Yeah.
And again, you've got Mongo shouting. They're shouting back and forth across the.
Alex Wright trying to make sense of all this.
What's he saying? And then you just got Eddie. He's saying there was a fourth man. He's saying there was four. Yeah. The chaos is just absolutely brilliant.
Jimmy Hart trying to get anybody's attention, and you're just thinking like, what's going on? It just cuts this back as this, you've just seen this brutal mugging almost of these two guys just coming in and just beating everyone up. And you know, you've got the great spot with Rey Mysterio, which he does well, and Zabisco does, you know, that almost borderline immortal line. And it's just, it's the selling by everyone. I think it was absolutely selling by everyone. You're absolutely right with the whole thing with the baby face and the heels commingling and everything. You know, with Alex.
And the thing, just to jump in there just quickly, G, it's the first time that you've seen this in a national promotion. ECW had done it before, but how many people had seen it in truth? So it's the first time that any wrestling fan has seen anything remotely like this.
Arn selling the arm like he's been shot in the arm. He's just absolutely clenching it, and just like, she's just crying, man. It's just like absolute, like, realistic tears of just like, she's just crying like Arn's fucked. It's like his arm is only hurting, but she's treating it like, you know, he's just found out he's got cancer and AIDS on the same day.
just
as someone's paid, just as someone's just as someone's, you know, pissed in his car. You know, it's just like, she's just like,
not
just
to mention,
absolutely selling it beautifully.
Not to mention Scotty Riggs having to get to hospital for getting hit in the face with a bag, you pussy.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful face, you know, so he had to have reconstructive surgery.
That's true. It's noted here in the Observer that the angle itself was a ratings killer for the night, it should pay off in the long run, adds Meltzer. Over on Raw, Steve Austin in the main event against The Undertaker. Austin wins by countout due to Mankind's interference. Ahmed Johnson's injury from the kick from Farouk, and Farouk's debut was announced as being a ruptured kidney from the attack. Obviously, Raw for the next few weeks was actually taped the same night as the previous week, where Ahmed got kicked. So Ahmed does appear on shows for the next couple of weeks, even though he suffered a real-life injury. Nitro did a 3.0 only here. Fell to a 2.9 in the second hour after the big angle. Raw only did a 2.1, so Raw's not looking too good. Barry Windham has been signed and is coming in as the Stalker. He's not going to be a stalker like the kind of people that stalk celebrities. More of a big game hunter gimmick, says Dave Meltzer. Unfortunately, they'd save that gem for DDP. Vader is said to be 360 pounds, down from 410, after Vince McMahon said that he was too fat to get over earlier in the year.
Get over the ropes.
Yeah, but apparently he wasn't in the same svelte condition as Andre the Giant, King Kong Bundy, and King Mabel. August 5th, 1 week later, Luger and Sting versus the Nasty Boys and the Giant versus Craig Pittman in the main event. At one point, Sting and Luger went to the vacant limousine and found a wreath of flowers sending condolences for the death of WCW from the NWO. It's actually a play off the real life thing that Jim Cornette did to Jim Herd when Flair left WCW in 1991.
God bless Cornette.
Over on Raw, which again was taped 3 weeks ago, Ahmed Johnson wins an 11-man battle royal to get a shot at Shawn Michaels for the world championship in the future. For this Monday Night Battle, WCW does another 3.0 to Raw's 2.8. The big story here is that viewers were switching to Raw in droves throughout the show as it went on. Raw opened with a 2.2 and showed phenomenal growth, ending at a 3.5 for the Battle Royal. Nitro opened at a 3.4, but lost its audience after a horrible interview by Sting and Luger, who have a lot of heat on them because of it, and it ended in a 2.6. So, not too good there.
Yeah,
this is really the closest at this point that Raw's come to actually beating Nitro again.
It is, and it speaks a bit to what G was saying earlier about, whilst a lot of what WCW is doing is almost laying the groundwork for forging ahead at a later date that hasn't quite broken through yet into the consciousness of the viewing audience. If memory serves me correct, though, there is a fantastic Ric Flair promo on this show, where I don't think it's mentioned because it's not part of the main event, or it may be the following week. So you'd have to help me out if I've got this wrong. Where what's left of the Horsemen in terms of Mongo, Benoit, and Ric Flair beat up the Booty Man. They knocked $10 a share of him, and you've got a great Flair promo that's almost forgotten about, but it's on the Horsemen DVD. And they just, it's Flair at his sort of almost chaotic best, wide-eyed, mean jeans in the ring. Flair brings the camera in as it follow him out to the ring, follow him onto the outside so he can put a few more boots into the Booty Man. Gets back in the ring. You think you woke up one day, Hogan, and became a bad man.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of, it's the sort of the tit for tat atrocities, if you like. They've attacked Anderson, his best friend, so they've beat the crap out of the Booty Man. Mongo and Benoit not so great on this segment, but I love Flair.
There was a great when Anderson returns it again. I think it might be the following week where he has like great line where he says, "You forgot the first rule of combat. You send one of us to the hospital. You send one of them to the morgue." It's a great double A line. August 6th, one day after the airing of the Battle Royal where Ahmed won airs, Ahmed Johnson is rushed into emergency kidney surgery and is in intensive care for several hours due to his kidney bleeding after the kick from Farouk, the original ruptured kidney. So Ahmed's push here is pretty much nullified. Ahmed, who seemed like he was on a roll here and is pretty much being pushed as the third biggest babyface in the company, is out for months.
And in truth, that was really it for him.
Yeah, he never really got back to the same level.
That was all she wrote. He'd be blighted by injuries after that. He'd be blighted by weight gain after that.
Yes, he would indeed.
Harlem Heat 2000.
Not a fan of Big T.
I think I once described Big T as Ahmed Johnson after he'd eaten himself.
August 11th, it's WCW Hog Wild, a show that does absolutely no money because it was free entry for the biker Hicks in Sturgis.
But there's two things Bischoff likes. It's karate and bikes.
There was a blackout in California which caused some pay-per-view purchasing issues.
Fucking Enron.
No, 0.62 buy rate here. 154,000 buy, so less than the Bash did for Hogan getting a title shot against the Giant here.
And it's also worth remembering that Harlem Heat were not particularly popular during this pay-per-view.
Actually, Dave Meltzer has his theory here.
Okay.
And this is a direct quote. I guess those bikers don't like the coloured folks. So that was the thought. Obviously, Hogan wins the WCW title here, spray paints the belt with NWO, which was cool as fuck at the time. The fourth member of the NWO was scheduled to debut on this card, and it was supposed to be Sean Waltman. However, the WWF has yet to send him his contractual release after agreeing to do so, with the belief that they're trying to fuck with WCW.
Yeah, more of that petty nature between the two companies.
Oh yeah, Waltman was at the show and ready to do the angle, but WCW wouldn't let him on without the release.
So what did they do instead?
Well, they did the angle where the Booty Man, the aforementioned Booty Man, comes out and gives a birthday cake to Hogan, and subsequently it's the shit kicked out of him again.
Yeah. Oh, glorious.
That's his perfect role for him. Bring him out and watch everyone just beat the fuck out of him. That's how you end each fucking Nitro. Guaranteed to get ratings for that.
We do have to talk about Hog Wild a little bit. The annual money loser for the company. And it's sort of it's those things you look back on in retrospect. You see the warning signs there with Bischoff, almost that throwing good money after bad type situation where he's willing to piss the money away, almost just for his own amusement.
Well, totally.
The spray paint when he started bringing that in. What's your opinions on that as a kind of like a sprinkles on the old Sunday, basically,
that's
in terms
great.
Of the NWA as a kind of like angle? Because I always just find it funny where it's just like, with this dastardly group beating the fuck out of everybody, breaking the law, and they also add, you know, mild graffiti to the list as well. Like, God damn it, just the spray and everything.
They're a gang. It's gang mentality. Never been done. Fantastic.
Spraying Rick Flair as well, which I think is probably a bit later. Yeah, it's just that. It was such a
spray painting the belt. I mean, they treat that like it was sacrilege on Nitro. Yeah. That was awesome. What a clever touch.
Yeah, such a great thing to have, really, kind of branding, you know, the title in that kind of gang mentality. But it's just like, every time I watch that, I always feel sorry for the people they're spray painting, because it's just like, because they spray
they're getting paid.
I know, but it's just like afterwards they got to get that shit off. I'm just thinking they're spraying it on their back as well, so it's just kind of like,
I always wondered what it was. It could have been legit spray paint, surely, because that's got to be terrible to get. It's got to be like just some kind of
They probably bought it from the fake wrestling paraphernalia shop.
Fake chairs, fake tables, fake everything.
Yeah, obviously.
In which case, they should just be grateful that none of them were Roddy Piper'd.
Oh God! Oh God! Well, that would have got over in Sturgis, just wouldn't it?
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Anyway,
do we boo him or do we cheer him?
Let's rev those engines.
I'm gonna rev my engine anyway.
Depending on which side of the ring you're standing on, one side will boo and the other side will cheer. And then he turns around and they just counteract again.
The Shrewsbury Hell's Angels department's gonna come looking for me now.
Yeah, yeah. One night later on Monday Nitro, Flair versus Savage takes place. Hogan comes in with a chair shot and cuts a fucking terrible promo here on Ric Flair. This is the real one of the real bad Hogan promos. So he says he's got a new name for Ric Flair, the stupid little man. Really terrible stuff.
All that cutting edge stuff, and dolls up that softball.
Yeah, Hall and Nash in the main event, wrestling for the first time on television against Sting and Luger. With the this is the match where Nick Patrick interferes, pulls Scott Hall out of the way for the Stinger splash.
Nick Patrick looking exactly like Kenny Powers, by the way,
and delightfully so. Mm-hmm. I thought he was really good here. For a little while, Patrick was good. Since he started having to sell some punches, I wasn't so fond, but you know. Raw, on the other hand, was built around constant teases. Vader doing a planned attack on Shawn Michaels. Sonny being on television with no clothes on as a tease. A tease of Bret Hart's announcement about his retirement, which ended up being that he will make an announcement in the future. Gorilla Monsoon's announcement about the IC title being vacant. And Shawn Michaels in the main event against Owen Hart. And Raw only does a 2.0. Nitro does a 3.3. This may have been the biggest margin of victory to date. A 1.3 difference here between Nitro and Raw. So we're seeing Nitro kind of hovering around the same level, but Raw's losing traction.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to say. Yeah, you can see obviously that they're gaining ground over WWF, but it's more WWF are losing viewers. They're not, you know, Nitro isn't really gaining. They're still around that kind of that mid
3.3 to 3.5
yeah,
area,
basically. So it's still, like as I said, it's still that momentum. They're still while the TV's kind of good, at least in like certain areas. The NWO as an overall company gimmick hasn't quite caught on yet because they're still just drawing the same viewers.
No, but at least I think the one thing you can extrapolate from those numbers is that it reflects a sense of WCW at least has a direction, they have a plan, so that those numbers are consistent in you know, they match with that. Whereas WWF, you don't know what they're doing. They're not entirely sure what they're doing. Hence the multiple teases on that Raw.
Yeah, yeah, they're getting desperate.
They're a rudderless ship. They've got no direction at present, and as such, the numbers are fluctuating all over the place.
A couple of interesting notes from this week's Observer here. Diamond Dallas Page wants to do a deal where he would be the Stevie Richards flunky to Ric Flair, but Flair is said to not be so hot on the idea. This is before Page really gets any kind of real traction or following from the audience, so interesting little thing there. Also here, Lanny Poffo is also under WCW contract making 75 grand a year, and there's no plans of using him whatsoever.
Yeah,
must be nice to be a nephew or a brother of a top wrestler in WCW.
Well, at least when it comes to Lanny Poffo, they learned from that mistake and didn't repeat it.
Of course.
Oh, wait.
They just paid a lot more.
Yeah.
Much more.
What was the line before? Good money to bad, whatever it was?
Throwing good money after bad.
Throwing good money after bad. I like that a lot. The World Wrestling Federation is adding a weekly Saturday night pay-per-view, according to several sources within the company and an independent trade journal report. The one-hour show will be done live every Saturday from New York City starting at midnight. The show will be heavily aimed at the adult audience, which most take to meaning a more risque ECW-like product. The show has been proposed to both request and viewer's choice within the past week, and reports are that neither company is accepting the proposal. The working plan is for a $9.95 show. Titans attempt to do a more adult show may stem from its being beaten badly in the adult market by WCW. The WWF at this one has a 61% lead on kids, and WCW has a 61% lead on adults when it comes to the ratings on Monday night. I remember this being brought up at the time in Power Slam. It's been like why weekly pay-per-views for $9.95? What a shitty idea!
Thank God no one would do it.
Yay!
Yeah, I mean we just saw the buy rate for In Your House International Incident.
It just speaks to that complete sort of panic-stricken mentality they've got at that point. You know, no one with a sort of clear frame of mind would think after the bad numbers their pay-per-views are doing. I know, the way to increase interest and eyeballs on the product is to have more pay-per-views. 52 a year, in fact.
But I think what is interesting, though, from that is they were already willing to go down the more risque route. It's there in the back of their minds to do it. They obviously don't want to commit to their...
There's been traces of this all year.
Obviously, you know, as we're saying, you know, this period is so interesting as we see things evolve and fall into place. You know, particularly the language and the use of women, tits. They knew they needed to try and get some kind of a new niche because they're getting their asses kicked and the product was so stale. So even then, it's interesting to me that they had it in their mind, we're going to go the ECW route
We just need to come up with a new platform, and
Yeah, but even it's interesting. You can see that the balance and the dynamic and the question they've got within themselves. They're losing the adult audience to WCW. They have to think, if we go in the adult audience and it doesn't work, and we lose the kids as well, we're up shit creek. We've got nothing to show for it. So I can understand why, because this whole year seems to be like this tug of war between Diesel flipping people off at the Royal Rumble, and then, you know, the Goldust character, and, you know, Warrior saying ass on television and stuff like that. But again, like you said, there's traces all the way throughout, but they're not committing.
No, exactly. It screams confliction, doesn't it? Because you would eventually see that in what Shotgun Saturday Night,
and that's what it would become.
Ended up becoming. And, you know, Vince's idea of Edge at that point, because of his unwillingness to commit to it, is a sunny sex tape with Elmo from Sesame Street where the camera cuts out.
Yeah.
You know, it's the nuns attacking the god wins. It's it's Rocky Maivia on the show for some reason.
It's Jim Cornette helping a midget piss in the urinal.
Yeah, with the heart shape on the underwear. It's almost, like you say, Kieran, there's those traces there, and there's a theme in mind with this later show, a more risque outlook perhaps. But again, Vince can't break away from what he knows and what served him so well.
Yeah, I think that's what I find interesting. It's like it is an insight into the mind of Vince McMahon. It's like they must come up with so many shit ideas, and obviously a lot of them get through. I always have done, always will do. But yeah, that commitment, we've got this idea, we've got this direction, but they're going to keep what they've got, and that's why they've never turned Cena, because this is what we've got and it's there. I mean, why lose that if we're guaranteed this? It's just very interesting looking into Vince's psyche.
It's kind of interesting considering, you know, ECW at that point was still just, it wasn't a major league company. It was just, you know, it may have had some TV in syndication here and there, but it was just like, it was still, you know, lower leagues, and yet they're looking towards them for inspiration. I know ECW was great at that time period, but it's just like, if your main product is being catered to 61% children that you're quoting, to suddenly do like another show to try and hone in on the adults, it's just like, that's like the worst thing you can do. You have to pick your direction. You can't divide your company at all.
Well, that's Vince all over. Once every single way. Yeah, the attitude here is still, they're selling Stone Cold condoms in one shop and action figures in the other. Yeah.
Austin 316 says, "I just fucked your ass." What we've got this week is Raw, a 3-hour Raw, with they're trying to, you know, mix and match, and I know it becomes the same bullshit anyway. But, you know, they try and claim they cater for different segments on the same show kind of thing, and you get this, a mix and match of bullshit, which, you know, you want to watch half the show kind of thing.
I've never really 100% bought into this whole, like, we have to focus on the, you know, the young market as such, you know, like they were doing, you know, back in the 80s or this particular time period, or even now, as just like children of the almighty dollar. Why the fuck would you pick the most fickle demographic in the world, you know, where kids, like, one minute they will love wrestling, and the next minute something else will come along, they'll love that. I've just, as a business standpoint, I've never fully understood why Vince would always put his eggs in one basket unless he's forced to, like he was later on in the Attitude Era.
Okay, interesting timing here. Timing could not possibly be worse for Raw. The US Open comes a-calling and preempts Raw for the next 2 weeks. So the show is moving to a one-hour special on Friday, September 6th, headlined by Shawn Michaels versus Goldust for the WWF title. There is talk that this Friday night special is an experiment for a new time slot for Monday Night Raw. Meanwhile, WCW TV, on August 15th, they have the Clash of the Champions, which is a 3.5. Not a bad number, but it's well down from the 4.5 that the January Clash did. This is where the giant drop kicks and pins Chris Benoit in 23 seconds. In the highlight of your fandom for the Big Show, Carl.
Yep.
And it's Flair versus Hogan, babyface Flair versus heel Hogan for the first time. It's in a pretty shitty disqualification, truth be told. 2.5 for the first hour, 4.2 for the second. So it's not really an overwhelming deal there. I'm curious if the Olympics played havoc on the first hour there. That Sunday, August 18th, it's SummerSlam. A 0.58 buy rate here. 145,000 buys. Well down from the previous year, which did a 0.9. This is Shawn Michaels versus Vader in the main event, the Paul Bearer heel turn. Thoughts on this show, generally speaking, when it comes to, you know, impact on the Monday Night War? Anything that really stands out as a major takeaway here?
I watched the show more recently, and just the show in general, my opinion was just poor. I mean, the Bearer heel turn, I guess, obviously was essential for, you know, the direction they were going in with Mankind and Undertaker feud. The Shawn Vader, I remember, kind of like, particularly with the finish, was unsatisfying, and it just
It's a complete clusterfuck of a match.
I enjoy it though. I think it's a good match. Sean's hissy fit aside.
It's not that it's a bad match, but in terms of
Overbooker Mania.
Having any sort of meaningful impact, it's negligible. This SummerSlam show doesn't, in terms of the landscape of that time, is neither here nor there. I think the only thing that's sort of noteworthy about it is again that poor buy rate. When you consider this is what is traditionally their second pay-per-view in terms of the prestige, for that to have drawn a number less than the Great American Bash, to draw a number less than Bash at the Beach,
to do a number less than Hog Wild,
I think it just whilst it changes nothing in the landscape, it just emphasises the difficulties the company are having in comparison to WCW, which, as we've said before, whilst not breaking ahead at a million miles an hour, is at the very least steady and stable.
I was stunned that Vader lost.
The reason for the low buy rate, I think, in my opinion, is just the way they're handling Vader up until this point.
Totally.
I mean, you got to think, from Vader coming in, debuting at the Royal Rumble, in 96, if they had actually built this guy properly, if he was even built half the way he was in 93 in WCW as being the monster, then I'm not saying that this would have been guaranteed to make a difference, but like a monster Vader beating Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam, that would have been newsworthy. In terms of like the whole Monday Night Wars, you know, maybe some WCW fans hearing about this thing, like, old Vader used to be in WCW, used to be champion here, he's just won the belt over there, that could have enticed maybe some viewerships, not like a huge copious amount, but it could have teased a lot of viewers to move to WF. I think if they'd actually built Vader up properly enough and had him beat Shawn, I think it could have made a bit of a difference. Nothing major, but it certainly would have done better than what they did draw.
Yeah, the shitty booking of Vader for the entire 8 months leading up to this, I think, is largely responsible for the low buy. Because Vader didn't seem all that credible. He's just a fat heel. He wasn't a monster. He was just a fat heel. They treat him like a Bam Bam Bigelow.
That's it. And whilst we can sit here and say it may have helped somewhat if Vader had won by SummerSlam, really, the horse has already bolted and you haven't shut the stable door. It's been and gone. The window on Vader and any relevance really has already gone before you get to SummerSlam, at least in my eyes.
August 19th, Monday Night Raw. Vince McMahon is not announcing. Kevin Kelly replaces him this week, and there's a bit of a motion for Kevin Kelly to replace Vince McMahon, believe it or not, this time. They pretty much stack this card, though, where Owen Hart versus the British Bulldog. Vader does a stare down with Mark Henry. There's a four-man battle royal with Goldust being Sid, Steve Austin, and Savio Vega for the Charlotte Michaels on Raw Championship Friday that we mentioned previously. And it's headlined by Shawn Michaels beating Yokozuna, who is inexplicably back with Jim Cornette as a heel with no explanation whatsoever. And as a little factoid, this is the last Yokozuna match on Monday Night Raw.
Good.
On Nitro, most of the show was built around Nick Patrick's heel turn as referee. Sting and Lex Luger were supposed to wrestle Flair and Anderson, but instead had a lengthy discussion and settled it like men. They all agreed to be partners against the NWO at War Games for Fall Brawl. The finale was The Giant versus Randy Savage, which ended in 47 seconds when Savage just hit everyone in the Dungeon of Doom with chair shots. So Nitro here, 3.5.
Nice.
Raw does a 2.9, jumps right back up after SummerSlam. Combined audience of a 6.4, he was one of the highest ever for Monday Night.
That's definitely an increase, overall, isn't it? Yeah, they just Nitro gain a 0.2 and a big increase for Raw.
Interesting bit of news here on the ratings. We just mentioned the high ratings there. As far as head-to-head quarter-hour analysis, for the second week in a row, the biggest gap between the two shows was when Shawn Michaels was on. Last week's Michaels-Owen Hart match only did a 2.0, while WCW finished with a 4.1. This week, WCW again ended with a 4.1, while Shawn and Yoko only did a 2.9, the lowest quarter-hour of the show. So Shawn Michaels, not doing too well here.
It's just kind of, as I've probably said on previous podcasts before, I've never, in retrospect, watching this time period back, I've never bought Shawn Michaels' run as babyface champ. You know, performance-wise, you know, he was really good outside of his tantrums. I never saw him as a babyface until, you know, his second run when he
much
came
better
back
as a babyface.
Yeah, much better when he was older, more mature about things.
But it's these comparisons of what the focal points of the two companies are. We've talked there about there's this grittiness and real sort of element to the over on Nitro and that sort of gang warfare, gang mentality, it strikes a chord for what is at that point a changing world in the sort of end of the mid 90s, getting into the later 90s, and the rise of the anti-hero, which obviously you get a bit further down the line. You contrast that with the babyface champion,
the
teen idol that, or sort of all the kids are going to love and the girls are screaming after, and you know, you can't fault Michael's in-ring performance at all during this period, but it's not the sort of thing that a wider audience wants to gravitate to, particularly not that 18 to 36 male demographic.
Well, this is the interesting thing here. These are just some random obscure figures. The reason why they were going this direction, G, you were asking before about why they would focus so heavily on kids. At the time, on Monday night, the adult audience was obviously the key to victory. There were twice as many adults as there were kids and teenagers combined watching on Monday night. However, on house shows, WF was doing the best numbers they'd done in years, because the kids and the teenagers would go into the live shows, taking the families, blah, 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 blah. The year before, Raw, we mentioned that at the very start of this series, in 1995, for the summer of 95, Raw's ratings were through the roof. They were so high, but the house shows under Nash just fucking sucked ass. This time, ratings have collapsed, but the house shows are the best they've been in a long time, which is why Vince is going in this direction. He's making money with Shawn Michaels.
And the business model at that point hasn't broken away from the house shows. It's still the house shows that are the bread and butter, and in many respects, the
TV life, rights was not a big deal.
It's still the lifeblood of the company. Is that the sort of the death of the house show in terms of its importance to a company's bottom line wouldn't end for another couple of years? In truth,
house shows also a massive indicator on for their business, on the direction they're going to go up until that point. So, as you say, it's understandable why they still went that direction at the time. I know you said earlier, G, about the to understand, you know, the position towards the kids. Got to say, I completely disagree in principle. At the end of the day, why don't you appeal to everyone? But I think for me, wrestling, you absolutely, kids are massively important, because you lose fans all the time as people grow out of it, and you need to create new fans all the time. And the ones
who
all
become fans around this table,
kids, and the ones who gravitate to it first are kids. Apart from the attitude era of take that out because it's an anomaly, and who's to say those teenagers who came back and watched the Attitude Era weren't initially hooked as kids earlier on? So
that was exactly the case with you, wasn't it, G?
The kids create obviously a certain amount of windfall for the company. I'm just saying, it's when the company just concentrates on that only as a windfall, it's a dead end, because, like, sorry, kids don't have credit cards, and they haven't.
But their parents pay to take them to the show, so you get four going rather than two.
The parents do, right? And this is the key thing. There's a difference between if you just got the kids interested and the kids are going, oh, mommy, daddy, can you take me to this? And they're kind of like, oh, okay then. So the parents are sat there reluctantly, and they're just paying merchandise for the kids. There's a difference when you start honing into the parents. So the parents are buying merchandise for the kids and buying merchandise for themselves because they're interested in the product.
Ultimately, this was the direction to go, clearly.
Yeah, obviously, because in the Attitude Era, when they started, you know, they kept the kids because, you know, the cool kids watched wrestling in 2000.
More kids are watching when they made it an adult-themed show. That's exactly a paradox, as we'll get to.
Exactly, and it also honed into the adults. So, yeah, you still kept that child demographic, but you got the people with the credit cards watching as well. That's the thing, you know.
Biggest, if I remember correctly from my old marketing days, biggest spending demographic 18 to 24.
That's what they usually concentrate on ever since the 1950s, I think, or something like that. Yeah, but it's always been.
So moving to August 26th, this is the first of two unopposed Nitros of the US Open preempting Raw. The main event is Benoit and Mongo against Sting and Luger. This is the angle where Hogan, Hall, and Nash hit the ring, attack Sting, Luger, and the Four Horsemen, and leave them all laying. Hogan spray paints NWO on everybody, spray paints a black streak down the middle of Ric Flair's hair to make him look like a reverse skunk. This angle's brilliant. This is when they first Hall attacks Mongo, and they scream Scott Hall, which as a fan kind of jolted me a little bit at the time when I was a kid watching Nitro. It's like, I know that's his real name. I read it in a magazine. This is probably the best angle the NWO has done since the one that we mentioned before with the lawn dart.
Yeah.
Rubbish in the ring. Nash gets bombed with drinks.
Yeah. It's just great stuff. And I, the only thing I was watching when I was viewing this was just like, this is all great stuff, the NWO get their comeuppance, you know, the Four Horsemen get them back, and it's that's what eventually becomes the issue with the NWO angle.
When
we get to it, you know, that it's such a great angle, and I'm just thinking that, like, this is a great way to set up the babyface comeback, where it's like, you fucking humiliated the Four Horsemen and Sting, the two acts that have been in WCW since forever, and then, you know, you three jamokes come in and try and ruin everything. And it's just like, it's built into such a great storyline of you know, the established guys fighting back.
Well, you know, they did it right.
We'll get to what they did with
it. I think that's for another day. I think
that is for a few podcasts down the line.
At this point in time, they're doing exactly what they should be doing.
But no, I think the point though is correct. I mean, what was that? 5-on-1? 5-on-3, sorry?
6-on-3.
6-on-3 and 3-win. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's in terms of, you know, positioning as heels, it's got to be the pinnacle before you pay something back.
Yeah.
But it's got so... I don't know. Some of the angles that follow are even better. Yeah,
but surely the biggest victims of the NWA, though, with the Horsemen. I mean, I watch these shows, and I just think the Horsemen are so out of place.
Yeah.
I think the best thing they could have done was all of them jumped over to WWF, where they starved the talent and done an angle there.
Two of the debuts on the show, Ted DiBiase shows up in the crowd, holds up four fingers, and then eventually five fingers. Everybody's questioning what Ted DiBiase's links are at this point. Chris Jericho also debuts on this show against Alex Wright in a match that ends by count out, and Jericho doesn't want the win, if I recall correctly.
Basketball highlights number 12.
With no competition from Raw this week, Nitro set its all-time record doing a 4.3. The second hour was the highest rated hour for a non-special wrestling show dating back to the mid-80s. The rating peaked midway through the second hour during the Flair and Arn Anderson versus Rock and Roll Express match, doing a 5.0. So there you go. The current plan is to introduce Sean Waltman or someone else as the next NWO member on the September 2nd Nitro, but I believe there may be a backup plan if Waltman's deal isn't worked out. Also in this week's Observer, the future plans of Bret Hart become a major topic of discussion this week, based on several reports that Hart may not return to the WWF despite all the television hype building his return over the past few weeks. WCW has continued to make a play for Bret. This will almost surely be the best opportunity of his career, and an opportunity that few have had in history to in the business. Even if Hart really has no interest in going with WCW, it would be in his best interest to get the word out that he does and negotiate back and forth. So we see in this the initial seeds.
The seeds are being sown.
Yes, they are. Something very, very interesting we'll get to in a few podcast time, obviously. While this isn't confirmed, the reaction almost everywhere to the idea of weekly pay-per-views seems to be negative. And if it does take place, it won't be anytime soon. So that's the end of that, pretty much.
Wait till 2002.
1 week later, September 2nd, The Giant becomes the new member of the New World Order. What's everybody's thoughts about The Giant joining the NWO?
And so it begins.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, completely, this is the start of fucking up the recruitment. It should have been, 1-2-3 Kid.
Yeah.
Giant, for me, was one of the few guys they had. I mean, we're saying how, for me, the Horsemen seemed completely impotent and kind of, you know, lost in the shuffle. For me, Giant was the one guy. Yeah, we're not waxing lyrical over Paul White's ability here, but given his size and it being relatively protected still, he'd obviously got the win over Hogan. He was the one for me who should have been the staple of WCW, the guy who NWO couldn't beat because he was so big and bad.
Well, they'd already fucked that up by having Hogan beaten for the belt at Hardwire. Yeah. So it was all much a muchness by this point.
But even in that regard, it's the sense of here's the big domineering character who has the axe to grind with the NWO, and without rhyme or reason, he's just trotted out to choke slam members of the Dungeon Doom. Not very well, if I remember rightly, one or two of them. Mm. But it just, it's that first move that there doesn't seem to be much rhyme or reason to for me.
It just didn't fit for me.
It doesn't fit, because it's not that. I know they downplayed the WWF sort of tie-in at this point, but it's the first non-WWF guy or with any track record with the company to join them. And like I say, it's coming off the back of him dropping the title to Hogan in a screwy finish where he's completely shafted out of the belt. It seemed somewhat illogical to me.
But I think they could have done, for a brief period of time, a great kind of angle with the Giant where it's just like, as you said, he's the one guy, the NWO, even with the numbers game, they can't take out. The numbers game, you can take out a Sting, you could probably, you know, fight man on man with the Four Horsemen, but someone the size of Giant, it could be believable that he could take down the NWO when they try and fight him. So
it's just even as simple as a guy who the NWO would actually sell for.
Yeah. He will be the secret weapon of the WCW. He's the cat. Like, to quote a film, you know, like with the Avengers, when Loki turns around and says, "We have an army," and you know, Tony Stark turns around and says, "We have a Hulk." It's like it's kind of like the same thing. It's like, you know, the NWO kind of building their forces, but WCW has the giant.
The thing is, to Liam's earlier point, like, you've already seen that the numbers game can catch up with the giant. They've already done that at Hog Wild, but you can still have that person who has, even with the numbers game and the way they've already played that out with the giant, you can still have that individual who has that intimidation factor.
Yeah, and they ended up using that as a template for Sting. But
well, as I say, they keep the shirt of Sting a load of times, and they still have rehabbed him. Yeah. Well, I don't. There's no excuse for it in my mind. It's just bad planning.
The turn was a last-minute plan when the original... Imagine that. When the original idea was, on the first anniversary of Nitro, to duplicate the angle that put the show on the map where Luger surprised everyone. This time it was supposed to be Davey Boy Smith. 4 days before Nitro, on the day his WWF contract was set to expire, Smith signed the 5-year contract with the WWF. Titan and Smith have been going back and forth over the past few weeks regarding actually signing the contract when negotiations with WCW picked up. What, if any, verbal deal Smith may have made with WCW is unknown, but when WCW shot the angle last week where DiBiase said he's going to introduce 4 and 5, WCW did believe that Smith was going to be number 4. Vince McMahon got wind of this on August 28th, called Davey Boy Smith up with Jerry McDivitt, and was absolutely furious. And by the end of the day, the deal with the WWF was made. So the Giant's turn was WCW's last-minute panic move. The other plan was that Sean Waltman was again going to debut, but the WWF again didn't give him the contract release. So
it's Dick Dastardly's fault with that damn pigeon.
I know. It's in the mail. It's in the mail. So yeah, also interesting to note on the actual execution of the turn, Hogan switched the booking of this drastically. The original idea was that Hogan was finally going to be outnumbered by the Dungeon of Doom and the Horsemen, and the Giant was going to come out and join in, but then make the shocking surprise and save Hogan's ass. Hogan just changed it to they're slaughtering all of them, and then the Giant just comes out and joins in. Ric Flair once again made noise about taking time off after the execution of this angle. Steve McMichael was said to be furious with how everything went down as well. I can't believe this! is what I imagine he said.
But I still don't necessarily see why they still had to go with the angle of introducing the fourth or fifth guy.
They'd already teased it on TV. They had DiBiase doing the 4 and 5 and saying next week. It's explicitly telling them, you're going to get it next week.
Yeah, but it's... I don't know. I don't think they... I think they could have got away with like postponing it a little bit. They're the fucking heels, for Christ's sake. They could turn around and just say, actually, you know, not just yet. You know, we're gonna wait till the opportune time. They could have maybe bought some time.
Yeah, but,
surely.
But forget the idea that this is heels on TV making this promise, and think more along the lines of this is the company making this promise in the midst of a war.
They don't want to let people down.
Bullshit. I'll do it for them. All you do is you've got all the NWO in the ring, and they're scheduled to take on someone, and you go to the back, and the opponents are down. It wasn't NWO, the three guys in the ring who beat the shit out of them. So who beat the shit out of them? It was 4 and 5 with DiBiase planned, and maybe next week we'll see them. And it's exactly how they built the NWO to start with, and they could have done exactly the same thing then. So it's only impatience that fucked it up. So.
It's that impatience in the midst of a war.
Yeah.
But they did that before, and it worked, so why not do it?
They could have bought it, because that's the thing of, like, rather than just kind of, like, you know, promising something and immediately shooting their load, it's just, it's dependent on how brave you are. How long can you sustain the tease for?
But,
really,
but this is forget what they did with Sting and look at the company's overall track record. This is a company that opened Nitros with world title matches in 95 and early 96. Yeah. They have a reputation for blowing their load, so it's not it's not out of the realms of possibility.
It's not out of character.
It's not out of character for them to panic. Think, shit, we've promised something, we'd better deliver, because God knows if we don't and lose some credibility as a result, God knows how many views we might lose to Raw.
We might lose the lead. They were terrified of that.
They've got TL Hopper, and he looks like a Gangrel from 2015.
Funny note here. Hogan and the Giant, obviously Giant does the promo at the commentary booth, and they tip the table over. $40,000 worth of damage in something that wasn't planned. So thank you very much for ruining the table there. Another 4.3 here for the unopposed Nitro. So a lot of viewers from Monday Night Raw are checking out WCW and what they're doing here. There's talk this week that Jeff Jarrett, who has signed with WCW, is NWO bound, and Bam Bam Bigelow is in talks to join the NWO apparently as well at this time. Kurt Angle, who won the gold medal in the 220-pound Olympics, received an offer from Linda McMahon this week. No word yet on whether he's accepted. He would not. there have been interviews shot this week with Farooq holding the Intercontinental title. Small little tidbit that we'll get back to. This brings us to Raw Championship Friday on September the 6th. Here we go. This is fucking marvellous. Jim Ross said he had the biggest news story of his 20-year career and revealed that Razor Ramon and Diesel were negotiating to return to the WWF. Vince McMahon didn't even come up with this angle until the night before Raw, at which point very few in Titan were clued in on what was going on, and most in the company were stunned at Ross's announcement on the show. Of course, this is headlined by Michaels versus Goldust. Michaels wins clean with a moonsault. But the big news here, obviously, and we know where it's going, we'll get to the payoff in a minute. Okay. But, yeah, just desperate times.
Was JR doing his gimmick by this point?
This is the
best
start.
He hasn't
done the big thing
he's
yet.
He's starting to evolve into.
Just say right here, despite being the main focus of hype on syndication and on cable for 2 weeks, to the extent that the Mind Games pay-per-view has now been downplayed, the Raw Championship Friday wound up doing a 1.8. That alone quells any chance of Raw moving to Friday night. So there you go, there's a failed plan right there.
In what is a historically bad night for US television anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, speaks to the panic.
It does indeed. September 9th, 3 days later, Raw. Ross says that he apologises for his comments because they upset delicate negotiations with Razor Ramon, but he's standing by his story and that negotiations with Diesel were going strong. Kevin Nash and Scott Hall had absolutely no knowledge of this angle, and they found out on Friday at the house show when Championship Friday aired. This ends up with, hilariously, Kevin Nash and Scott Hall being given bigger contracts by WCW.
This is great story.
So basically, they hadn't signed their contracts. They'd signed deal memos agreeing to the numbers that they'd negotiated back in March. It should be noted, around this time too, the Steiner brothers, who'd been in the company since March, signed contracts around this time as well. So they'd been in the company for 6 months without contracts. Nash and Hall had been in for about 3 months without contracts at this point. When this happens, WCW just shits themselves, slaps deals on the table for $780,000 per year to both of them, and they both just say, okay, and sign them. And there you go. Now you got us under contract for more money. And they were never going anywhere anyway.
The poor business sense of WCW for the fact that these guys weren't signed to solid contracts till then. Then the stupidity to actually not really do their research as to like what's going on. And it's just like Nash, as he's telling the story, is just hilarious. As he's just like, he's just pulling faces going, they just offered us more money and we didn't do anything. And when it actually gets to not preempt what you're going to go into, when he eventually do the angle, we realize who Diesel and Razor Ramon are. It's just saying they were watching on the monitor in the back, and just everyone just kind of did like a double take, just looked at Nash, looked back at the monitor, and just realized, oh fuck, we just wasted however much money, however, like, you know, six figures on people we already signed. And it's just
paranoia born out of their own actions, I think. It's just you know, after the Luger, oh fuck, they're gonna Luger us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Totally is. Again, Carl, watch that line.
It's throwing good money after bad.
There you go. So we're getting that in again. Over on Nitro, they do the imposter Sting angle. It looks like Sting has joined the New World Order, jumps out the limousine and attacks Lex Luger. Yeah. At that point, the WCW rating had hit a 4.2, and after two straight unopposed weeks, they were going to hit their first ever opposed 4.0 rating. However one wishes to analyse what happened next is up to them, but the 4.2 fell to a 3.2 in 15 minutes. Given the lack of growth on Raw, most of the 700,000 homes that turned off Nitro simply stopped watching wrestling at that point in the night. So the Sting angle, short term, when after people believed that Sting had joined the New World Order, fucking tanked ass.
Well, besides also the viewership tanking, what was your opinion on that whole Sting angle?
It was brilliant.
I thought it was pretty clever from the fact of, obviously, with Sting's characteristics of he wears face paint. It's a lot easier to kind of disguise someone as him as say just a, like a normal wrestler. It is noticeable that the guy's a fake Sting just for the fact that he does a good impression of him. He's noticeably got slightly thinner hair on top.
All that matters was in that one night when he gets out the limousine with and it's raining outside in the parking lot.
Oh God, yeah.
And DiBiase's got a brolly.
DiBiase's got the brolly, and it's obvious he's joined the NWO at this point. He's part of the New World Order, and Luger's is getting beaten down on the ground outside in the rain. Yeah. It shot from a distance once the initial reveal happens. All it mattered was on the first night. People were misled on the first night, and that's it was just a mechanism for where they wanted to go, and where they wanted to go was the absolute right way to go. Flair and Arn Anderson, right after they do that angle, hit the commentary booth and do fucking great. Arn especially does a great promo hyping up War Games and saying he doesn't know what's going on here, but he doesn't like it, and fuck it, we're going to War Games to kick some ass. WCW also spray paints the limousine outside afterwards, which
it being rainy, they try
you can't see
Savage tries his best.
He does. So anyway, here, ratings for the night. Nitro does a 3.7 to Raw's 2.4. WCW basically doubled the WWF's adult audience here, with 66% to 34% margin. So, adults,
they get that Saturday night show in quick.
Well, my man still wants to do the late Saturday night show from New York, but the idea of doing it on pay-per-view has been dropped. Imagine.
God, damn it, I want to see Sonny's tits.
I'm going to find a way to do it. Gene Okerlund's contract with WCW expired this week, and he's no longer with the company. Between Okerlund's base contract and his cut of the hotline, it's believed he's earning $420,000 a year and was looking for a raise. Okerlund spoke with Vince about coming back, but not a lot of interest was shown, so there's a good chance he'll return, and he eventually did. But still, $420,000.
And just on that note, can we remember what Ric Flair's base pay was at that time?
I don't remember it.
Because I'm sure it was below 400,000.
I'm sure it was.
I want to know how many people are calling that fucking phone line.
A lot of people.
Jesus Christ.
Still huge business for a while. Two things of note here that will become more obvious later on. J.J. Dillon, one of the main talent liaisons and bookers, resigns from the WWF this week. Jake Roberts, he of no-showing the pay-per-view fame, is added to the booking committee. Yeah. So, couple of questionable things there, but we'll come back to J.J. Dillon shortly. Yeah. Moving ahead to Fall Brawl on September the 15th. 0.65 buy for 162,000 buy, so the numbers still haven't jumped up noticeably yet.
But still notably better than WWF's pay-per-view buy rates.
Yeah, 11,300 fans in the building. In the stipulation, the NWO actually won a TV show by winning the War Games match here. It was the best Greensboro attendance in 8 years, who clearly came for Horseman Revenge. Horseman merchandise outsold NWO merchandise 4-1 on this show. And a funny note, Dusty Rhodes, the Daily Show, was trying to politic his way into being the leader of the babyface group against DiBiase so they could do spots on the outside. But yeah, so there you go. Again, NWO wins here. This is where they do the angle where Sting comes in. They set the thing in motion, kicks everybody's ass to show that he can, and then tells WCW to fuck off. Yeah. NWO wins.
On my best of four brawl video,
it's this and nothing else.
I was entertained by the performances of you know, the NWO and Arn Anderson and Ric Flair in particular.
And when Flair gets in the ring and he just fucking hits the ropes and he's telling him to come on.
He's just like, ah,
you know. One by one, low blows and Arn rings. It's fucking great.
It was just great stuff, and I just thought and it's just that moment when he just comes out and it just like it's Sting. Disappointment in the announcer's voice is going, oh shit, it's Sting, like him as well. Yeah. And just like for those few seconds that you can buy it if you ignore the fact he's got thinner hair, and it's just like the pop as well. If I remember right, the pop from the crowd when the real Sting comes out is fucking huge. And he just, the one thing I always kind of drew me to Sting when I was younger, his comebacks, or where it was like the hot tags or whatever, basically his fire, basically when he comes back, he's doing like the back fists and so on, the kicks, and he's just going back and forth taking everybody out.
Stinger splashes
700 Stinger splashes in the corners and stuff, and then he just walks up and just says, is that good enough for you? Yeah. Is that good enough? And it just does the old, you know,
up yours
fist. I don't know. And it's just.
I love it. I think it's the next night when in hour one it's Schiavone and Larry, and it's like the explanation for it. Yeah, last week the real Sting was in Japan. And we should have known that.
we're such losers, and that's why we're on hour number one.
Yeah, but. Booking like Swiss cheese, says Dave Meltzer here. At the end of the show, Liz, who's with the Horseman, comes out to try and save Randy Savage. September 16th, Nitro. Savage does his usual promo, and Liz is back with the Horseman.
I think they did show the video. They showed it. They recapped it.
Yeah.
Because spray painted Liz's dress.
Yeah,
which is cool.
Hogan
spat on her.
Hogan originally wanted to pile drive her, but Bischoff vetoed it.
I'll bet he did. Dropping a different kind of big leg that night.
Sean Waltman finally debuts as Six in the crowd. And speaking of builds that have been highly anticipated, Glacier has his first Nitro match after months of build against Big Bubba Rogers. Works like Siama at half the speed. So there you go.
Snow falls from the sky.
Yeah, I like I dug the entrance. Crowd got into it a little bit too. Give him his due, Carl.
What a crock of shit.
Over on Raw, this week's twist was that Gorilla Monsoon announced that Scott Hall and Kevin Nash were under contract to another organization, and that while he liked Jim Ross, he felt he was somewhat hoodwinking the fans. Poor Ross is the one that takes the heat for this fucking scam. God. The angle, despite being the subject of more talk than any angle in a long time in wrestling, this being the fake Razor and Diesel stuff, has done nothing for the ratings. WCW won by its largest margin to date, a 3.6 to WWF's 2.1. So there you go.
The fans thinking, wow.
Hall and Nash are going back. Let's watch Nitro to see what they do before they leave.
Bear in mind, you've had the 2 weeks of unopposed coverage. Now you've got this run, and you're starting to see a gulf open up, at least in this sort of time frame.
A woman called the WCW offices last week complaining because her 5-year-old had spray-painted NWO on her 1-year-old.
Brilliant!
For life. Did they sue him?
I don't know. The current plan, which could change, is for the NWO to get a Saturday night show, either 1 hour per week or 2 hours every other week. Ted DiBiase will be the colour commentator. No decision has been made regarding the play-by-play man yet. But again, the idea of the NWO TV show is coming to life, and obviously this will manifest itself as the weeks go by in terms of the membership. Speaking of pay-per-views, here we go. September 22nd, Mind Games the following week. A 0.42 buy rate for 105,000 buys. 15,000 fans in Philadelphia. Shawn and Mankind in a hell of a match.
Yeah, I can't remember much of Mind Games apart from that main event. Apart from also, I think, was it before the show where Mick Foley goes out and cuts a promo?
Oh, there's something else. There's one thing I can certainly remember from this show.
Okay, so basically, Steve Austin had started cutting the promos on Bret Hart as they were teasing Bret. What was Bret going to do? This is where Brian Pillman had vowed to bring Bret Hart back to the WWF and failed miserably. So Owen Hart, Pillman, and Steve Austin just in the ring, burying Bret Hart and everybody in the building is just fantastic. And Carl, I know you want to get the line in.
Would it by any chance be the you put the letter S in front of Hitman and you get my exact opinion of him?
Absolutely it is. Great Pillman line here too, when Austin says, that's what Mike and Stone Cold said so, and then Pillman just follows it up with, yeah, and Philadelphia sucks because I said so. Cheapy at its finest.
Let's not forget Sid's horrific punches.
Oh god, at the end of the match, Jesus Christ almighty. Yeah. Mickey Rourke called and said those punches look fucking shit.
Yeah. You're always going to get magic, whatever you do, when you get Pillman and Austin in the ring at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
A proven fact. Yeah, in terms of Mind Games, obviously, I mean, I don't know really what you can say about that main event.
Hell of a match. Had no bearing in the big picture at all.
No bearing at all. Just great match. Probably probably my favourite match that Shawn Michaels ever done. But it's, probably Mankind just suddenly being put in that position.
But you got to keep in mind, this is after Foley at this point hadn't been beaten by Taker. He'd fucking owned him at King of the Ring. He beat him again, took his manager at SummerSlam. So Foley was pretty hot. But again, the promotion for this show was second fiddle here to Championship Friday.
As well, you say about Foley being a shock, but you look at the Michaels run, and it was Camp Cornette, one schlub, Bulldog had a couple, didn't he?
Yeah.
It does seem very kind of desperate, isn't it? It seems like, you know, like Mankind seemed to have a bit of kind of momentum behind them. Instead of obviously saving it, they decide, like, oh, let's just use him now.
Well, again, the original plan, like we said earlier, was Shawn and Jose against Bulldog and fucking Cornette here.
So let's be thankful for small mercies.
Yeah. Exactly. Speaking of desperate, by the way, just to move along, Razor and Diesel are spotted backstage beating up Savio Vega, what we've seen from a distance here. So we don't actually, the reveal hasn't happened yet, but we just see, oh my god, a guy that looks like Scott Hall and Kevin Nash is there! And also, ECW in the crowd here. The Sandman spits beer on Savio Vega
during the
first match on the show.
It's the first match on the show. I knew it was early in the show because Dreamer's there as well. Yeah. I believe, is Todd Gordon in the crowd?
Heyman's there with him.
Heyman's in the crowd. But yeah, you are seeing that sort of cross pollination, if you like, between the two.
Absolutely.
But just on a side note here, and something that I don't know how much credence everyone around the table would give it, but may speak to the poor long term planning generally of WCW when you think of. We mentioned that those two buy rates, and WCW's buy rate was a good, 60,000 more than for Fall Brawl in comparison with Mind Games?
162,000 for Fall Brawl, 105,000 1 week later for Mind Games.
You've got the bigger buy rate there, and obviously the hotter company. But then you look at the gates for the two shows.
15,000 for Mind Games, 11,000 for Fall Brawl.
And it speaks to something with WCW that you will notice over time. No matter how hot the company was, they never seem to book their bigger shows in bigger arenas.
Yeah.
Whereas WWF, even during this weak stage, they're still booking larger arenas. They're still able to get larger numbers. Now, I know there's been revisionist history with the WWF and in terms of what WCW were capable of drawing, but I always found it interesting with WCW that for their big shows, marquee shows, they didn't try and push them into larger buildings.
Do you think that precedent over time adds to the decision to do Goldberg Hogan on TV in the George Dome? It's so big. So it seems a grander occasion to them, even though it's a money pit, a money like.
Yeah, I think so, because you would see over time with Nitros as well, they'd run the Georgia Dome on more than one occasion, and they'd have larger larger TV buildings than they would have larger pay-per-view buildings.
September 23rd. WCW is pretty much all in Japan, so this is where the NWO does their pretty much the takeover of the entire show. They even took an ad out in the USA Today to tell everyone ahead of time, the NWO is taking over the show tonight. Vincent debuts and joins the New World Order here as well. And Kevin Nash gets in the line of... Yeah. Nash gets in the line, accept no imitations. Over on Raw, the great Jim Ross heel promo, where he basically, this is the one where JR gets to do the promo that, you know, I'm the best play-by-play man in the whole damn business. Vince McMahon fired me twice. Bell's palsy. I don't like the fact that my eye doesn't open up all the way. Now I'm going to bring back one of your favorites, the bad guy, Razor Ramon. And out comes...
Bogner.
Slice and Dice Ramirez.
Out comes the janitor. You know, it's just
it's terrible.
We're watching that. Fair play. Ignoring what happened immediately after. Fair play to Jim Ross on that freaking promo.
That was a great promo.
It was so brilliantly delivered and with such kind of conviction as well.
I just love the fact that he's cutting this heel promo on the company and the fans are cheering him wildly. Yeah. Although he does out Vincent Mann as the guy that owns the company in this promo too.
Yeah. It's just, I kind of watching that. I'm just going, he wasn't in the top 50 greatest talkers. Yeah, it's just like, God, if there was ever an example of outsider commentary, he actually had the talent to do something like that. I was just almost mind blown by just how good a performer he was in that particular moment. And then just obviously automatically ruined by, you know, this shit stain of a Razor Ramon, which obviously I was offended by when I watched it. Because I remember...
You weren't the only one.
On a substitute, I remember when I bought the Survivor Series 96, not to go too far ahead, the tape, and seeing Razor Ramon and Diesel in one of the Survivor Series matches and thinking, oh yeah, because, you know, I love Razor Ramon. I didn't like Diesel either. And then watching that tape and seeing these two bell ends.
Fucking Kane!
Yeah, Kane is like, you know, the guy who we
love. This wasn't Kane's fault. Yeah. This was not Kane's fault.
I don't know. That hair was awful.
No, but this was not his fault.
Even I'll give him a pass on this occasion.
Okay. Yeah, but, come on.
But yeah, just seeing these two douches come out and just thinking like, how they thought this was going to be a good idea.
They were flailing around in the dark. They were throwing shit at the wall and trying to see if anything would stick.
It was definitely shit on the fucking wall. Jesus Christ.
Shit on the floor, shit on the roof.
Shit on the curtains, it's just everywhere.
It was the climax of the Razor Diesel angle that now has to rank as the biggest flop since the Edsel, says Dave Meltzer. Funny, because he mentioned the Edsel on an Observer Radio about a week ago, so that's a funny little tie-in. It was the day after a fake shoot angle working with ECW. It also had the finals of the IC title tournament with Mark Merrow beating Farouk that was pulled from the pay-per-view show in order to help the rating. Not to mention the traditional bump that one normally gets coming the day after a pay-per-view and the fact they were going live. The TV absolutely reeks of desperation here. ECW crashed Raw. You know, Taz jumps the rail with a sign that said Sabu Fierce Taz here. Vince also reveals that Jeff Jarrett lip-synced it In Your House 2 here and that it was really the roadie that was singing. All of this, the results. Monday Night Raw does a 2.
Point.
Oh.
Monday Night Raw does a 3.4. So it didn't work, as it turns out.
Imagine that.
It appears, here's a little funny tidbit though, it appears that the end result of this, as it's being talked about right now, will be the WWF's main angle, attempting to create its own outsider group led by Ross that will include the heels that used to work for WCW, like Brian Pillman, Steve Austin, and Vader, along with Razor and Diesel. They're thinking about adding Mankind and Farouk to this as well, to go against Team WWF. So basically, for about a week here, in all of this desperation, they're thinking of just doing the NWO with Jim Ross as the DiBiase of the group. A completely forgotten piece of history there. Pretty much as soon as this happened, I think it was the day afterwards, they were trying to figure out ways out of the angle. They acknowledged that this was just a failure almost immediately. Supposedly, Vader has been promised the world title soon, although those kind of promises in wrestling historically mean nothing until they happen.
You say promise, but was he like said in jest? Like, I think it was probably in jest, and Big Leon took it the wrong way. You're not pushing me, man. Ah, oh, well, put the world title on you soon, son.
I promise.
I'm going to win the title.
It wasn't exactly like a Sid Justice type of promise, was it? You know, like, yeah, you will main event. Menu, is it? It's
funny how these promises stick with some and not others, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, we have one Nitro and Raw left to discuss. September 30th episode of Nitro, one of the worst Nitros in history. The television show was built around the NWO, and they were all having a party at the hotel room, so none of the NWO wrestlers, nor Ric Flair, Sting, or Randy Savage ever appeared before the live crowd. The main event was Chris Benoit versus Rick Steiner.
But please tell me Flair wasn't there because he was partying with the NWO just because it's a party.
Yeah. The Nasty Boys joined the NWO on this show. Jerry Sags bent over and spread his cheeks, saying he was doing an impression of Eric Bischoff.
I thought I was going to go in a different direction then.
Bischoff was so furious he actually left the commentary booth to call the hotel and yell at them behind the scenes. Real life, a little bit of news there. September 30th, Raw, Vader and Jim Cornette versus Shawn and Jose Lothario. Vader pins Shawn with the powerbomb. Clean! Imagine that! You've also got Razor Ramon versus Savio with the diesel run-in, which is the first time we saw Glenn Jacobs as Kevin Nash. Jim Ross says he brought in real athletes to play Razor and Diesel, and it wasn't a billionaire TED skit like McMahon came up with to make fun of people who are more successful than he is.
Oh my God.
Which is a line I can't believe he would say on the air.
God bless Jim.
Nitro did a 3.3 to Raw's 2.3, so even with a bad show, they still won by a full point. And that brings us to the end of September and the end of this quarter analysis of WCW and WWF in the Monday Night War. We will be back next week for the final quarter of 1996. Lots to talk about there, and we'll get to it next week. So final thoughts around the table about this quarter that we've talked about here today.
I just find this period in particular so fascinating, you know, to see what we know happens in later years. Everything is in place or moving there, or there's moving parts. We can see where it's going to go or how it's going to end up. It's just, I mean, little things like the stigma, the King of the Ring promo for Austin was, you know, the superstar making, but for months he did nothing. And
barely mentioned.
Was it the Taker match when he even had like a white logo on his black pants?
Yeah, the Austin logo on
it. He didn't have the music for months. It's
on SummerSlam following the King of the Ring, he's wrestling on the free for all against Yokozuna.
Yeah, barely mentioned here. You'll noticeably that he's absent from a lot of these notes.
And apart from that, I think this period, I think, was when he had lots of guys coming in. It seemed like every week when we were buying Power Slam or WF Magazine, but WF Magazine in particular, because that's when they did the profile.
The features.
Yeah. It's like, but it's like Ron Simmons. We'd already had Goldust, Foley come in. It's all these former WCW
Stalker.
Guys. Stalker. Yes, Stalker, absolutely. There's loads. Or guys, from the indies, like Smothers and people, T.L. Hopper.
Yeah, Tony Anthony.
Yeah. So many guys, they're getting guys in, and they just couldn't, they were so out of touch.
Yeah.
So out of touch, and no clue on a direction, and on the same show that they're promoting a cross promotion thing with ECW, which a niche adult audience would know about, while on the same show they've got this fake bullshit Razor and Diesel. Who's that? What segment's that appealing to? It's just such a mishmash and an absolute clusterfuck of ideas. Whereas on the other side, NWO and WCW on the back of it, absolutely, one week after the other, seemingly anyway, obviously give or take the odd anomaly, getting momentum, getting steam, even though decisions by this point are still becoming questionable. The seeds we can trace back, probably before this as well, to the eventual ascension of the direction WWF ago and the decline of WCW for the mistakes they made year after year and eventually caught up with them. So it's such an interesting period of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's not an awful lot I can add to that, to be honest. It's a very succinct and accurate description of proceedings for that period. We mentioned before, the last time when we covered 96, that it was almost sort of it had been a phony war. The companies neither had sort of advanced ahead of each other. They were swapping victories, but we referenced that there was at least some sense of a plan with WCW and not with WWF. As we're getting into the second half of 96, we're seeing that plan come to the fore with WCW. They're advancing forward, give or take 1 or 2 weeks. The gap is widening in TV ratings. Raw, when we mentioned halfway through 96, they're sort of directionless. By this point, they're in a blind panic.
Yeah.
And it's something that, and it's a gulf that will only widen as we go further down into the last few months of 96.
It's also quite interesting to see the actual war that they're fighting within themselves, actually, as well. They're kind of fighting themselves as well as each other, because, as Kieran was describing with WWF, they had a lot of great talent there, ironically, from WCW, but none of them being really placed in any kind of position yet. They're still clinging on to the past, or what they perceive to be the present, in like Shawn Michaels and Bret and this fake Diesel and Ramon that they're trying to do, whilst the answer is kind of right under their nose, and it's no better articulated than Austin winning the King of the Ring and just that momentum on that night just being flatlined like straight away, and really we don't really get any kind of more inkling of it again until in a couple months' time in November with Bret. you know, and Armour Johnson, you did have some sort of momentum getting injured. You know, it's just like a lot of bad luck, but also a lot of poor decisions as they're kind of fighting with themselves over what to do. They're panicking over, you know, what WCW's doing and not concentrating on what they're doing themselves. And it's because of this, they're making a lot of mistakes. On the counterpoint with WCW, everything's not smooth sailing there. Whilst they have something that's really fresh with the NWO, we're already starting to see the seeds of, like, adding people that didn't really need to be in there. You know, we mentioned the Giant, and it's just interesting, like, this viewing this time period, just seeing the figures in particular, as it's not like just a sudden boom. We're still in that slow progression, and just all the politicking in the back. I think it's quite a fascinating period.
Yeah, absolutely. To me, the most interesting 3-month block since we started this series so far, and there's been a lot of fascinating things that came to life, but to me, seeing this whole period of time, this 3-month period where WCW, they've struck gold, they know they've struck gold, and they're going all in on this big angle, and the WWF just has absolutely no idea what to do. They're looking at the ECW over here. This has got a lot of buzz, let's try and mooch off that. You know, a lot of these things that are just so desperate, and they just don't know what to do. We're going to see how this blends in the final quarter of 1996 next week, so check back in with us next week for Kieran O'Rourke.
Laters.
For G. John Chase.
Disco fever, yeah, 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 yeah.
And for Carl Jones.
He's so cocky, he's so cool, he's just a disco dancing fool.
I am Liam O'Rourke and we are out of here.